Now, Russia's attack in Ukraine is in its fifth day. The two sides met today for peace talks that are set to continue later this week. A number of countries across the world have condemned Putin's invasion, and the United States and other Western powers have stepped up their sanctions against Russia. Military, financial, and humanitarian aid is flowing into Ukraine, but the country's leaders say they're going to need more. We're checking in on the latest developments out of Ukraine to try and figure out what could happen next, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you feel about the reports coming out of Ukraine? Are you hopeful that the conflict could end soon? What do you think of the sanctions piling up from countries around the world? Do you think there needs to be more? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Danielle Lussier is an associate professor of political science at Grinnell College. She's chair of the Department of Russian, Central European, and Eurasian Studies there and chair of the Department of Political Science. Danielle, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
It feels like a lifetime in some ways, just a handful of days. What are your thoughts now 5 days into this Russian invasion of Ukraine?
Oh, that's a great question. I do feel like it's been a very overwhelming last 5 days. You know, as someone who watches this region very closely, for the last several weeks, we've been paying attention to changes on the ground and changes in the geopolitical atmosphere. I think things started to take a very ominous turn really a week ago when President Putin first recognized Donetsk and Luhansk as autonomous regions and then gave this very bizarre statement to the Russian public that made just some very aggressive claims that would suggest that things were taking a very ominous turn. That being said, I didn't necessarily anticipate a full invasion on Thursday. So now that we're 5 days into this, I think we're at a very interesting juncture. We've seen that Ukraine is proving itself to be very resilient to a military invasion for which it was unprepared. It's stayed very resilient militarily. It stayed very resilient politically. We've seen allies come together very quickly to put together a very aggressive plan of action to try to force the Russian government out of its economic comfort zone. So I'm thinking we're at a really interesting turning point right now.
The United Nations made a rare move to convene its General Assembly in a special session, many countries calling for an end to the war. I'm going to give a listen to UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres addressing the situation in his speech to open that session earlier today.
We need to look forward as United Nations to overcome the scourge of war. We need to focus on solving problems, not making them worse. In cities around the world, people are taking to the streets and demanding an end to war. People in Ukraine want and need peace. And I believe people in the Russian Federation do too. We need peace now.
The international response, we're seeing traditionally neutral countries like Switzerland stepping up and saying, yeah, we're going to hold Russian assets for now. Sweden and Finland contributing military aid to Ukraine. What do you make of this? And now Germany also widening its support for Ukraine. What do you make of this increase in the number of countries and the intensity of the support they're giving sanctions and to helping Ukraine?
I'm impressed with how quickly it has come together. I think obviously Switzerland setting aside its neutrality is a very important piece of this puzzle, because ultimately what we're seeing from Vladimir Putin is that he's not willing to simply come to the negotiation table. He needs to actually be forced to that negotiation table. He needs to feel it in such a way where he can no longer support this war. And it seems to be that a unified financial intervention is what's necessary. And Switzerland was a really important part of this. But it's not just Switzerland. I mean, obviously, that's a very significant piece. But I would say an even bigger piece has to do with the number of countries that have come together to essentially force the Russian central bank to have insufficient access to its currency reserves. These are absolutely necessary to prop up the Russian ruble. Without having access to the types of reserves that are held in foreign banks, it will be impossible for the Russian central bank to maintain its currency, the ruble is already losing its value very, very rapidly. We're likely to see a very strong and devastating impact on the Russian economy that will be impossible for Putin to avoid.
We're talking to Danielle Lussier from Grinnell College, looking at the Russian invasion of Ukraine. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you have questions about the news you're seeing from around the world, 800-642-1234. What you want to hear from President Biden, maybe at the State of the Union address tomorrow, what actions you ought to see taken or not taken in response. 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. It's been hazy, Danielle, as to what Vladimir Putin had hoped to get out of this. Are we starting to get a clear picture of what he was hoping the end game of this invasion would look like?
I think he was certainly hoping that it was going to go much more quickly. As best as we can tell right now, we see very little reason to think that he was prepared for a long-term invasion, right? We have troops that are running out of gas on the ground. He expected to be able to go in and essentially topple the Ukrainian government very quickly and then be able to negotiate some sort of ceasefire that would lead to a long-term political control, the long-term political control over Ukraine. I think going in, he envisioned being able to bring Ukraine, at least initially, back into Russian political control and ultimately potentially strengthen his overall grip on a number of different territories that had predominantly been part of the Russian Empire. Now, I think that since this has not gone as quickly or smoothly as he envisioned, the end game might be different. I don't think he was prepared for a war that would last many months. I certainly don't think he was prepared for having access to foreign Russian central bank assets being frozen and the inability to conduct a lot of Russian economic practices being crippled as a result.
One of the big stories of the last bunch of years has been misinformation campaigns interfering in elections around the world, including the U.S., but not limited to the U.S. And a lot of efforts seemed pointed toward breaking up NATO, creating divisions within NATO. It seems like this invasion, if there was any progress on that front, this invasion has just removed all of that. Did this backfire in a way that Putin may not have expected?
I think that's exactly right. I think part of the, thinking about the role of NATO in all of this, one wants to just sort of bear in mind that Ukraine has aspired for greater European integration for many years now, economic integration, but of course also wanting security guarantees. And those security guarantees go all the way back to the early 1990s when the Soviet Union was first dissolved, when Ukraine agreed to return the nuclear weapons that were on its territory back to Russia, primarily for the overall security of the nuclear complex. And in doing so, did so in an environment in which it never perceived itself as potentially being on the receiving end of a Russian military attack. The slow move or the gradual move that Ukraine has sought to gain greater integration into European economic and security structures over time has been perceived by Russia as being very, very threatening. And I would say many scholars, myself included, look at various types of Russian intervention into Ukrainian domestic politics going back over the past 20 years as one of the goals of that being to essentially make Ukraine so unstable as to make it impossible for it to join the European Union or ultimately to enter into NATO. So this goal here that I think has had for many years has to do with reducing these opportunities to bring NATO closer to the Russian border. And I think it's backfired by showing the strength. I mean, again, seeing Germany agree to meet its NATO commitments in terms of contributions to military armaments, et cetera. This has been something that I don't think Russia was counting on.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Michelle is with us in Madison. Michelle, hi.
Yes, hello. Thank you for taking my call. My question is regarding this sham negotiation table that Ukraine has been brought to, which appears to be purely about Russian grandstanding. I have a fear that the reason Putin demanded this show was because there is something that he wants people to be distracted from, or some action that he is buying time in order to be able to take. And I just wonder if anybody has been addressing these sorts of concerns or has any thoughts about what might be going on.
Michelle, thanks for the call. Danielle, it didn't see, in hindsight now, it seems like Putin wasn't negotiating in good faith leading up to last week. Is there any reason to think he might be negotiating in good faith starting this week?
No, I don't think so. But I do wonder if part of what he's trying to get out of this situation would be, now that it's very clear that he's prepared to continue and to continue in a very aggressive and dangerous manner, I wonder if he's thinking, okay, what can I get to extract out of this situation? So maybe I'm not going to get everything that I wanted. Could I still walk out of this situation potentially with something else? So for example, and I've seen this reported in a couple of places in the press, but again, none of this can be verified, that Putin was planning to go into today's negotiations with a demand that the international community recognize the sovereignty of Crimea. So for example, Crimea has been under de facto Russian control now for 8 years, but it continues to be recognized by the United Nations and the international community as being part of Ukraine. And the United Nations General Assembly voted to reaffirm that as early just in December 2019. So this has been an ongoing issue where the international community continues to recognize Crimea as being part of Ukraine's territory. Putin may be going into this saying, okay, look, give me Crimea, and I'm willing to consider a negotiation to cease other types of hostilities. Or let's recognize, for example, let internationally recognize these two separatist regions in eastern Ukraine, and let's maybe put forward in a couple of years a referendum that they could join Russia. So he may be trying to see what he could extract out of the situation to make it look like some type of domestic win, therefore, ending other types of ending sanctions and being able to move forward and saving some face.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Grinnell College political science professor Danielle Lussier about the latest developments in Ukraine. Still time for your calls at 800-642-1234 with your questions for our guest, your thoughts on the global response to the invasion of Ukraine. Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We pick up our talk now with Danielle Lussier, political science professor at Grinnell College, with us today checking in on how Ukraine and the world are responding to Russia's invasion. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think the international response has been strong enough? Do you worry about Russia's nuclear capabilities? Do you have questions for our guest? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go back to your calls now. Chad is with us in Reedsburg. Chad, hi.
Hi, thanks for having me. I have a quick question. So let's say that the sanctions do take hold and Russia is forced out for whatever reason. Is there going to be some penalty that Russia will have to face beyond that? So if they move out tomorrow, do the sanctions immediately stop? Or do we take Crimea back? Is the sanction continue?
Chad,
I'll take my call offline.
Thanks for the call. If this problem resolved quickly, what would happen next, Danielle?
That's a great question. It's kind of amazing the number of different instruments that were put into place in the past 5 days. And I don't think that any of those would disappear overnight, right? I think that we would see that there would be a gradual rollback of some of the sanctions, probably based on different elements of demilitarization. I mean, at this point, Russia has put, by best estimates, over 150,000 or approximately 150,000 troops into Ukraine. It has engaged in a wide range of other types of damages. Now, there are a couple of really important things that I think would probably be tied to some type of conditionality here as well, that the separatist regions in eastern Ukraine, which have been active, military zones for 8 years, with some exception. There's been some peaceful moments, of course. Russia has never taken responsibility for arming those regions, right? Those are areas that are called, they are termed as separatists, but there seems to be quite a bit of evidence suggesting that the armaments that have been used in that territory were brought in by Russia. So I could envision that there would be a range of different bits of conditionality that would have to come out before different types of sanctions would be reopened. I think the question of the status of Crimea, and I think the question of the status of these other regions would also probably need to be further discussed. I suspect, though, that there's going to have to be a very broader conversation that happens within the United Nations Security Council, as well as within sort of the broader international community, in the sense of, this has been the biggest assault in Europe that we have seen since World War II. I'm not quite sure what types of punishments Vladimir Putin will have to experience, but I don't think that it is going to be as simple as just lifting sanctions. I think that there's something much greater that's going to come out as a result of this. And I think that what we've seen so far, that's probably something that's going to come out when there's collective agreement among allies about what type of consequences Putin and Russia should face.
Thanks for that call, Chad. I wanted to ask you, Danielle, I know you've in the past had your eye on Russian public opinion, protest and dissent in that country. From as far as we can tell from our vantage here in the Midwest, what are we seeing when it comes to the reaction to the war from Russian people?
That's a great question. And I think that we have to sort of divide up the different types of different categories of the population, if you will. There has been a very strong and immediate calls of dissent from, I would say, the intellectual and artistic class, the leadership in Russia. There is an open letter of protest that's been circulated by Russian scholars and universities. There have been any number of musicians and members of the cultural elite who have spoken out against the war very vocally. There have also been a number of individuals out trying to protest the war. Of course, something we have to really think about is that Russia is a very autocratic regime. It is, one might even argue, in some places, it's a police state. So engaging in any street level protest is very dangerous. And yet, even within that, we see that people are going out there and they're facing the possibility of arrest, especially in some large cities. Now, the other piece that we need to think about is that Russian television media is state controlled and it's spewing an awful lot of propaganda right now. So the average Russian who maybe hasn't been following these details very, very closely went into last week with public opinion that looks sort of the following. You know, about 40% or more thought that the recent buildup in tensions between Ukraine and Russia was a result of the West, that this was something that the West had introduced. We have some data from about a month ago that suggested at that point in time that fewer than 10% of Russians wanted to see military action in Ukraine or wanted to support Russian military action in Ukraine. However, there was a much larger percent of the population that was willing to support, if these eastern territories in Ukraine wanted to separate on their own, they could. Now, I think we have some reason to believe that this propaganda is really working in some segments of the Russian population, that there are people who believe Vladimir Putin when he says that this is necessary. At the same time, I don't know that we have a good sense of how well many Russians understand what is entirely going on. There are many who seem to be very skeptical of the information that they're receiving, but at the same time, they're skeptical enough of other types of sources that they're having a hard time discerning the truth of what's in here. I do think that we'll see more anti-war support, if you will, or more anti-war sentiment expressed as the economy starts to collapse.
Time for one more caller. Stephen is with us in Cumberland. Stephen, hi.
Hi. Glad to talk to you.
What did you want to bring up, Stephen?
I have a question and a proposal. I have been watching this conflict and have a feeling that there is an issue of Putin's legacy involved here, from a much broader perspective than specific challenges to specific pieces of land like Crimea or the eastern regions. And my theory is this, that I think he is trying to cement his legacy at the end of his regime. And the final piece is the Ukraine, and he has announced that he wants to replace the leadership. The only way he can do that, in my opinion, observing what's going on, is to impose such pain on the population that the decency and the honorability of this distinguished man, Zelensky, has no choice but to resign on behalf of the humanitarian interests of his population.
Stephen, thanks for the call. Just a little over a minute left, Danielle. Is that a worry that the next step might be to inflict such widespread punishment on the Ukrainian population?
I would not put that past Vladimir Putin. And I agree with this caller. I think that Putin, this is what Putin wants for his legacy. He wants to reunite those great Russian lands. But I am more optimistic in the sense that I think we've seen such resolve among the Ukrainian people, and we've seen allies come in and really bolster up the regime and bolster up the state in ways that they can. And so I'm more optimistic that it will be impossible for Vladimir Putin to accomplish that goal.
Stephen, thanks for the call. Just in our last minute, Danielle, what things are changing and quickly, what do you have your eye on next?
What I have my eye on right now has to do with this possible potential movement into the EU. I'm really interested in seeing what's going to happen with these negotiations potentially continuing. And I'm also really, I'm watching also just to see how much more the Ukrainian resistance can continue, given that it's getting fresh supplies and more resources.
Danielle, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Danielle Lussier is an associate professor of political science at Grinnell College. She focuses on Russia and Eastern Europe in her work. She's the chair there of the Department of Political Science. She's with us today talking about the Russian war on Ukraine and where things go from here. Stay up to date on the latest news from Ukraine here on the Ideas Network. NPR will be bringing updates throughout the day. You can also go to WPR.org. Our colleagues at NPR, their reporting will show up there as well.